Today is March 24th, 2015. This is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources. This is a continuation of the public hearing on House Bill 5018, Department of Environmental Quality. We'll go ahead, and I want to recognize a special guest in the audience today, Mark Yeager from the City of Albany. Good to see you here, Mark. So we'll look forward to your public testimony tomorrow, if there is any. So we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 5018. And we'll turn it over to Mr. Siebert.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would just note that saved under yesterday's hearing date is a response to a question that was raised yesterday during the hearing about what the program was that reduced food waste at Intel and the department supplied a response, which is saved under yesterday's hearing date.
Thank you. And we'll go ahead and call up Mr. Peterson, Director Peterson. Again.
Good morning, Co-Chair Redfield, members of the committee. For the record, Dick Peterson, Director of the Department of Environmental Quality. With me today is Jim Royce. He's the DEQ's budget manager for DEQ and will be available throughout the testimony. So this morning I'm going to pick up where I left off yesterday when talking about significant changes over time with the agency. And I wanted to talk about these because we've been experiencing changes over time. And I want to talk about how we're modifying our approach and to best meet our goals that I described to you yesterday. First of all, real quickly, this chart shows the past 18 years of budgeted FTEs. DEQ has historically maintained staff somewhere between 700 and 800 FTE over time. The very last column is the proposed governor's balance budget. And just prior to that, the staffing, if none of the policy option packages are approved or reduction options are implemented. So you can see we've been fairly stable in terms of FTE over time with some fluctuation. What I really wanted to get into right away this morning is to talk about the work we do that has changed over time and how we're approaching our work. We also change the ways we do approach our work to ensure we are becoming more effective and efficient in our service delivery and in meeting our environmental goals. We engage more collaboratively with and have more partnerships with local, state, federal partners, and communities. We're more efficient in use of resources and with a more integrated approach to our work. We're working to involve all the right people in decisions that we have to make. We have a holistic approach to our work. For example, we look at an issue from a multimedia, air, water, and land perspective when we're looking at them. We work with communities to ensure that solutions are tailored to their specific needs, and we make our work and decisions more transparent. We are improving our website so that the public can better find information, and we have implemented an outcome-based management system, which I'll be talking about next. In an outcome-based management system, DEQ tracks its progress in meeting our goals, and this is how we correct course when we need to improve our results. DEQ does use an outcome-based management system to approach our work. We set our goals for the agency day-to-day work to meet outcomes. Our core work map is a detailed map, and it's on the lower left side of this slide. I'm not going to get into that, but just to show you, that's the core work by which we operate. We develop and use performance measures to help us determine whether we are meeting our goals that we have set. We conduct process improvement to improve efficiency in the agency. We are focused on outcomes over process. That's very critical for an agency like DEQ. We want to achieve the outcomes that we're striving for rather than focus on the process to get there. But we do improve process when it hampers our ability to produce desired results and to efficiently deliver services. In addition to our key performance measures, DEQ has developed more than 100 process and outcome measures that we evaluate on a quarterly basis. Quarterly reviews keep us informed about actions we need to take to improve our services and to better achieve environmental result. We have provided you with a list of our process and outcome measures, our most recent KPM report, and our most recent quarterly measure scorecard. I wanted to show you a couple of examples of how it's working within DEQ. So I'd like to walk through an example of how we use data and measures to improve the way we do things at DEQ. At the top of this slide, you will see the result of the measure percent of water quality facilities required to be inspected that are actually inspected. The target for this measure is 90% of inspections scheduled for a quarter are completed within that quarter. If a quarterly result are at 90%, that means the measure is in green. We're doing well. If the result is between 80 and 90%, the measure is in yellow. And if the results are below 80%, the measure is in red. For the first quarter of 2014, the measure was in red at 36.8%. A group of staff engaged in process improvement to help determine the causes of not meeting target and to develop the implementing solutions. Key solutions included improved inspections scheduled and an inspection manual to ensure consistent inspections at all of our permitted sites. We implemented these solutions agency-wide. The graph shows the results over 2014. The measure shows that using the new tools had the desired effect. While the measure remained in red for the rest of the year, you can see the consistent improvement in the measure each quarter, just shy of being in the yellow zone by the end of the year. This is the type of improvement we expect to see whenever we engage in process improvement. Here's another example I wanted to show you. The inspections example was one that took more staff and more time than many of our process improvement activities, the one that I just showed you. More frequently, we're engaged in smaller process improvement projects. In the example shown here, a team worked on improving how long it takes DEQ to contact someone who has filed an environmental complaint with the agency. The goal is to contact complainants within 2 working days of receiving a complaint. As I reported earlier, in 2014, DEQ received 3,471 complaints. As you can see, in 2012, we were achieving the 2-day goal just over 10% of the time. A team worked together to develop solutions and implemented them amongst all staff who do complaint intake. Solutions included drafting a standard procedure for staff to use, included clarifying agency policy and defining 2 working days so that staff had the same understanding of what that meant, making improvements to our complaint database, and training managers and staff on the new procedure and how to use the updated features on the database. While we are not yet achieving this goal of 100% of the time, you can see from the graph that we are contacting complainants within 2 business days 80% of the time. That is significant progress based on the solutions developed and implemented by the process improvement team. These are just 2 examples that we're using within DEQ, and there's many, many more to focus on achieving the outcomes that we're striving for, and we take this very serious, not only in an improvement way, but in a transparent and accountable way. And I'm very excited about this type of engagement within the agency to be accountable for the work that we're doing and deliver on the service. This next slide is just a summary of our key performance measure results for 2014. There's much more detailed information of our KPMs in the KPM report that is included in the appendix of material. I'm certainly happy to go over any one of these in detail if you would like. What I'd like to do, however, is talk about 3 KPMs that we're interested in deleting.
And why don't we finish the presentation and then come back to the KPNs? I would like to discuss the ones that are in the red and also the one in the yellow, and just kind of for the panel learn a little bit more about that.
Happy to do so, co-chair. So here are the 3 KPMs that we're proposing to change. KPM 5 is the measure of percent of impaired water body miles for which a TMDL has been approved. There's a flaw in this measure. The number of impaired water bodies is updated every 2 years. This ever-changing baseline makes comparisons over time very unclear. We have other KPMs that I showed you yesterday, KPM 9, A, B, and C, that we believe provide us with timely and meaningful information on water quality. So that's why we're proposing to drop this KPM. KPM 7 is a measure in the pounds of mercury removed from the environment through DEQ efforts. Mercury removal efforts have declined and are difficult to quantify consistently. DQ plans to develop a toxics reduction measure that would address not only mercury, but a range of toxics that have adverse impacts on people in the environment. Finally, KPM 10, this is a measure assessing the quantity of diesel particulate emissions. The current diesel KPM no longer provides a realistic goal to measure our progress. While DEQ's clean diesel program based on diesel education and a grant program has had a very positive impact, emission reductions are nowhere near enough to reach the 2017 cancer risk goal set by the legislature in 2007 and used in this KPM. Also updated measuring diesel emissions is only available every 3 years. DEQ is requesting the deletion of this KPM, and we're proposing that we will return next biennium with a more meaningful and timely diesel KPM for your consideration. So now I'm ready to shift gears and get into the governor's recommended budget. That starts on slide 52. Moving to slide 53. This chart represents DEQ's 2015-17 governor's recommended budget by program. The highlighted oval shows DEQ's operating budget. That includes 723.7 full-time employees, FTEs, and $213 million in total funds for ongoing agency operations. The debt service column is for bonds issued to fund orphan site cleanups and to provide match for federal Clean Water State Revolving Fund capitalization grants. The last column, Clean Water State Revolving Fund loans, represents one-third of the total budget. This part of the budget is characterized as non-limited. This chart shows the distribution of funding for DEQ's programs in the 2015-17 governor's recommended budget. The three major programs, air quality, water quality, and land quality, are roughly split evenly in terms of total funding and comprise about half of the budget. Agency management is 7% of the total budget. 38% of the total budget is either non-limited, Clean Water Revolving Fund, and local government loans or debt service on bonds. None of this part of the budget supports ongoing DEQ operations. This chart indicates general fund uses in the DEQ current service level budget. This forms the baseline for developing reduction actions. Debt service cannot be offered for a reduction. This chart shows why water quality activities show up predominantly in general fund reduction options. Once debt service is held harmless, water quality represents 3/4 of all agency general fund. Package 70 details reductions implemented by DEQ to balance the budgets of the identified activities to available funding levels. DEQ is requesting restoration of most of these positions, with the exception of two in water quality. I will discuss these requests of restorations later when I talk about policy option packages. The next two slides summarize our general fund 10% reduction options. I wasn't intending to walk through all of these, but I'm happy to do so unless you'd like me to. The items shaded in gray are those that are implemented in the governor's recommended budget. So this is the first slide of the first 10 of the recommended budgets and or the reduction options, and the second slide is the next 10. And regarding reductions, 10% reductions, these are lottery fund reduction options that were identified by DEQ. Neither of these was implemented in the governor's recommended budget. Shifting to House Bill 5520A, budget note on air quality standards that we were required to provide. DEQ's 2013 budget bill included a budget note asking us to report on the status of the National Ambient Air Quality Standards for Ozone in a number of related issues, such as a plan and timetable for a new or update of the current Portland ozone plan, how in that process DEQ will assess the vehicle inspection program, and how modifications to VIP would implement air toxics, other emission reduction strategies, and DMV vehicle registration process. DEQ sent copies of the budget note report to all members on February 27th, and a copy is included on our website. As I mentioned earlier, EPA recently proposed a new ozone standard, and they have committed to finalizing it in October of this year. Once finalized, DEQ will begin work on the update to the Portland ozone plan. Now I'm going to shift gears and get into our policy option packages. Package 111, air toxics monitoring. The 2014 legislature provided funding for monitoring equipment and a year-long air toxics monitoring study in the Swan Island area north of North Portland. This policy package requests operational funding to use the Swan Island equipment to monitor in other areas of the state once the year-long study is complete. The monitors from Swan Island Project are designed to be mobile and easy to set up so that they can be moved to other locations where there are likely air toxics problems. Having monitoring data will help DEQ identify the sources of air toxics in the new areas, develop target solutions, and communicate to the public about those risks. The Swan Island monitoring will be completed in the fall of this year, and this package would provide general fund to continue the 1.52 FTE that was committed in 2014.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir. Dimbro.
Dick, do you have thoughts about where the next stop for this equipment will be?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Dimbro, we have not yet. We would get through certainly this monitoring period in Swan Island, depending on where this is going to go, we would analyze the areas where it'd be most likely, but we have not identified an area yet. Package 115, coordinate air quality scientific data contract. In a coordinated effort, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho contract with a consortium known as Northwest AirQuest for meteorological emissions and modeling data. DEQ uses these advanced models to make wood stove curtailment calls and develop air quality protection plans. Washington and Idaho have managed the contract with Northwest AirQuest for many years, and it is time for Oregon DEQ to take its turn. The three states use federal funding for the work. EPA would provide the funding for all three states to DEQ. DEQ would develop the contract for Northwest AirQuest and make payments to them. DEQ needs additional federal limitation to make payments on the contract. Package 120, wastewater permitting system. This package will allow DEQ to replace an outdated and inadequate wastewater permitting information management system with a commercial off-the-shelf product. We intend to buy a system that is capable of supporting our water quality permitting program in the near term and serve as the foundation of an agency-wide permitting system in the future. This package includes one permanent full-time position and $325,000 for professional services. Package 121, water quality assessment data. This package provides critical resources to do our fundamental work, assessing and reporting on the status and trends of water quality throughout the state. The package supports development of a data management system and provides resources for analyzing and interpreting the data and making the information available to our partners and the public. Water quality status and trends information is not only fundamental to DEQ's water quality work, but it informs and shapes the work of other natural resource agencies, organizations, and local partners to protect and restore Oregon's waters. Package 123, Restoring the Wastewater Permitting Program. Revenue projections for 2015-17 fall short of what we need to support the current staffing level. This package restores six FTE that are unaffordable due to shortfalls in federal fund and fee funds. If not restored, permit issuance would be slowed down, and we would have reduced resources for technical assistance in determining compliance. We understand that a 12% increase is a lot to ask. We have been in discussion with stakeholders and the regulated community regarding their expectations of DEQ should this package be approved. And we did agree with them to formalize a couple of commitments that could be formalized in a budget note. The first has to do with reporting on our progress toward improving the performance of our permitted system. The second is to hire a contractor to evaluate our wastewater permitting system and make budget-neutral recommendations on additional steps we could take to improve performance. We also discussed setting aside up to $125,000 from the water quality permitting budget to cover the cost of this contractor. We will work with LFO and sort out details prior to work session on DEQ's budget and a potential budget note for this item. Package 124, Portland Harbor Coordinator. This package establishes a senior-level policy position that will be housed at DEQ but reports to the Governor's Natural Resource Advisor. The position will represent the Governor's interest and help facilitate state-federal coordination on the Portland Harbor cleanup and other high-priority projects. A little side note on Portland Harbor, we're nearing the time when we're going to get a record of decision from the Environmental Protection Agency, and the state's role, holistic role in this is incredibly important as we work to finish that cleanup in Portland Harbor to start to revitalize the industrial economic part of the state, which is critically important. So that's really the necessity of this position. Package 126, reducing non-point source pollution. This package restores two positions and creates two new positions to work with public agencies, local organizations, and individuals to reduce non-point source pollution. DEQ staff provide the necessary water quality expertise to ensure water quality improvement projects are effective and achieve environmental outcomes. Package 128, quantifying conservation outcomes. This package supports DEQ's participation in a multi-agency effort to develop and begin using consistent metrics and reporting methods for determining water quality status and trends. This work forms the basis for the Governor's Clean Water Partnership, which you will be hearing more about from Richard Whitman tomorrow morning. This would phase in 6 full-time employees, and it also includes $250,000 special payment for the Institute of Natural Resources to develop a data management portal, $100,000 one-time and $20,000 permanent capital outlay for laboratory equipment, and $300,000 for contracts for development of a registry and quantification tools. The Governor's Office has been in conversations with natural resource agencies and key stakeholders regarding this work. The outcome of these discussions may result in some changes to the work these positions will be doing. I will make sure you are updated on these developments in advance of work session on our budget. Package 132, Materials Management. Package 132 stabilizes funding for this fee-based program. Revenues have declined as waste volumes declined. This package approves an increase in a fee set by rule and increases a fee set in statute. The fees will provide adequate funding for the program, repurpose 7 vacant positions from other land quality programs, and add funding for contracts and grants to local governments. These positions will reduce exposure to toxic chemicals and products home, schools, and local government environment, increase and improve prevention and recovery of high-impact materials such as food and plastics, increase opportunity for individuals and businesses to prevent and recover waste, help businesses reduce waste, improve recycling markets, focus state and local government and industry purchasing on lower-impact products, increase food security by capturing edible food waste, and measuring environmental outcomes for more informed decision-making. Package 136, continue activities to prevent introduction of non-indigenous species from ballast water. The request is a fee increase in general fund to maintain a 50-50 cost share between fees and state support. The funding is required to maintain the current service level of 1.5 FTE in order to support a 12 to 16% vessel inspection rate, verifying compliance, and providing technical assistance to ship operators, monitoring of vessel arrivals and ballast water management reports, increased staff time for policy coordination, assessment of regulatory developments at the U.S. Coast Guard and U.S. EPA, and outreach with local maritime industry, improving consultation and coordination with the shipping industry and other stakeholders, and participating more frequently in statewide invasive species management activities. Package 138 supports marine oil spill planning prevention and includes the review of response plans for facilities and pipeline. The goal is to review these plans within 90 days of their receipt, and to conduct and attend drills of those plans with industry and local emergency responders. The goal here is to participate in 12 drills per year. The fee increase will restore the program to 3.35 FTE. Package 150, process improvement. I've spent a lot of time this morning, well, not a lot of time, some time this morning, talking about our commitment to outcome-based management and improving and modernizing how we do our work to ensure that we provide excellent service and achieve our goals. Package 150 provides limited duration and permanent positions to support three critical goals. First, to evaluate and transform our business systems and practices. Two, strategic investment in modernizing our systems. And three, workforce development. The positions in this package would also support implementation of DEQ packages 120, which was the replacing wastewater permitting system, and 121, water quality assessment, transforming the data into knowledge, information and knowledge that I talked about earlier, and a joint project between ODOT, Department of Agriculture, and DEQ to develop a new time and attendance system. Package 181-191 is a Clean Water State Revolving Fund. $150,000 is asked for costs associated with bonds issued to provide the state match component of up to three federal capitalization grants. $30 million of additional loans using the federal grant monies received, and debt service for general obligation bonds issued to meet the state match for up to three federal capitalization grants. So that is a run-through of our policy option packages for the committee. I was just going to spend a minute talking about proposed legislation that DEQ has proposed, if that's okay. House Bill 2451 authorizes DEQ to allow 30-year repayment terms for all projects eligible for state revolving fund finance. These longer repayments make water quality improvement projects more affordable for those that are borrowing the money. Senate Bill 261 increases ballast water fees by $18 per vessel arrival to fund current service level, and it's also in Package 136. This is one of those discussions that we've had where some policy policy committees also provide approval for fee increases that will come to Ways and Means. This is one of those. Senate Bill 262 increases marine oil spill prevention fees to fund current service level and add one position for spill planning and response drills, Package 138 that I just talked about. Senate Bill 263 updates waste prevention and recycling requirement goals. That's being, I believe, being discussed in the Senate Environment Committee. Senate Bill 245 provides stable funding for materials management program through an increase in the tipping fee that supports those programs. Again, that's in front of the Environment Committee and part of the funding package that will come here. Senate Bill 246 authorizes EQC to establish an on-site septic system loan program targeted to low and moderate income homeowners. This is for repairing and replacing a septic system that can be very expensive, and many Oregonians aren't not able to afford the expense or obtain financing through conventional means. So this would allow us to set up a program and to provide the funds with priorities that would make that available to the correct areas where we have either groundwater, surface water problem from septic systems. That too is being discussed in a policy committee. So that gets to there, Chair Rayfield. I can go back to the KPMs if you'd like.
Yeah, that would be great.
Certainly.
Chair Rayfield, can I ask?
Yes, Senator Dembrough.
As we're looking at these KPMs, it would be useful to know, particularly for those that are in the red, how the policy option packages are designed to address those.
Sure.
Or where they are.
Yeah, I can do that. And at your request, Chair Rayfield, I'm just going to talk to the ones that are in red on and yellow. That's right.
And there are some slides on the just.
Yeah. Actually, they're in your book in the KPM report that should be available to you. And I can reference the page number that the graph is on that I'll be talking to. Does that?
Yeah, that would be helpful.
Okay. So the first one is customer satisfaction, and that is on page 8 of the KPM report. I think Chair Rayfield, the speaking points I have might, if you have the graph, it's great, but I think the speaking notes I have will.
And Mr. Chairman of the committee, I would just note that it's the report that the director's referring to is saved in the appendix that's under yesterday's meeting date, and it's page 69 of 163 pages of the appendix.
So the first one is KPM1, Customer Satisfaction Rating. This is a DAS statewide measure. It measures the percentage of customers rating satisfaction with agencies' customer services good or excellent for overall satisfaction with timeliness, accuracy, helpfulness, expertise, available of information. We track this measure for our air and water permits in the on-site septic program. So how do we perform? The target is that 85% of DEQ's customers who rate our service as good to excellent. The result is 72% of DEQ customers rate DEQ services as good to excellent overall. So what does it tell us? We are in the process of some agency improvements that should result in higher satisfaction rating in the future. We're evaluating and streamlining permitting processes. And we're updating our website to make it easier to find information and do business with DEQ. Connecting back to the policy option packages, certainly the requests we have in the water permitting arena will help with that customer satisfaction. But most importantly, I believe Package 150, which is looking at repurposing some of our agency management staff to work on business system improvements, will absolutely make a big difference in terms of contact. I will also tell you We don't have a package here, but our presence in the field, our decentralized nature of our agency, and our further investment that we've been doing and growing as far as regional solution centers and regional solution staff is making a big difference in terms of access and response. But we take this extremely seriously. We really want this to be in the green, and we'll continue to work hard to make that so. The next one, air quality permit timeliness. This is ACDP permits issued within Target. ACDP permits are basically the smaller or the less emitting permits for air that we issue. They're not the big Title V permits that we talked about. So that measures this one. So this KPM tracks air permit timeliness for these smaller and medium-sized industrial facilities. Where the percent of air contaminant discharge permits issued within the target period. Businesses absolutely need quick turnaround times on permits to construct, expand, or modify their operations. And DQ has set a high standard for issuing permits in a timely manner. For many years, this measure was a key economic development benchmark for the state and was tracked by the Oregon Progress Board. So again, how did we perform? The target is 90% of our ACDP permits are issued within the target periods. The targets range from 30 days for simple permits to 365 days for the most complex permits. The result is 80% of our ACDP permits were issued within the target period. So this is telling us that while 90% timeliness goal is not being met, DEQ prioritizes work and makes sure that critical permitting gets done. For example, permits that must be issued before a source can proceed with a construction project receive high priority and get processed before more routine work, resulting in more routine work not meeting timeliness targets. However, maintaining adequate staffing and continuous improvement to permit processing are the key actions to achieving and maintaining the timeliness goals. Next month, our EQC will consider an air quality permitting rule update that will reorganize and clarify air quality rules and should help to make permitting somewhat easier. I would tie this performance back to that package 150, looking at our business systems to make them more streamlined and more efficient. That would also, I think, very much improve our timeliness targets here.
And Director Friesen, mm-hmm. when the permits aren't obtained within that timeline, what's the effect on business or other entities?
Chair Rayfield, a couple of things. Number one, if it's a construction permit, they cannot operate unless they have the permit. So if it's a new permit and it needs a permit to allow them to proceed and construct, they can't do that. So that's the consequence to a business is not getting it out on time. They can't proceed with their project.
Does this KPM, would this also have some effect on the KPM-1 as far as customer satisfaction as well?
I would imagine, Chair Rayfield, if we were to interview or ask a air quality permitting their satisfaction, they didn't get their permit on time, they would probably rate it pretty low. So I would say, yeah, it's very directly connected. I would say everything we do in the agency is kind of tied to customer satisfaction. These are targeted for permitting and on-site, but really our performance is reflected overall through these measures, I believe.
Okay, thank you.
Oops. This is a percent of total wastewater permits that are current. I think I'll talk about both these and the percent of wastewater permits that are current. There's timeliness and permits that are current. So I'll walk through both of these together. So they measure the efficiency of our water quality permitting program. I'm going to talk about them sort of in reverse order. I'll do four first because I think it makes more sense that way. KPM-4 tracks the percent of all federal and state water permits that are current. That means they're not expired or backlogged. Currently, we manage about 8,300 permits in this category. So how do we perform? Our target is 80% of wastewater discharge permits are current. The result is that only 58% of these permits are current in 2013. Clearly, there's a lot of room for improvement, and I'll come back to that in a minute. The vast majority of these permits are general permits, where for NPDES permits, there's roughly 9 general permits for every 1 individual permit. Typically, we do not have problems keeping general permits current. And a general permit is you write a permit and you authorize activities under that permit. So an individual permit means that individuals will get an individual permit. That's just a simple distinction. So individual permits themselves can be harder to keep current, in part because they are getting more and more complicated and are more likely to be held up to a legal challenge. So now, flipping to percent of wastewater permits on timeliness, this KPM3 tracks timeliness in issuing individual permits in the water quality program. The target was that we issue 50% of individual permits within the timeliness period. We're issuing 14% within a timeliness target. Obviously, we do not meet this target. In fact, pretty fail miserably against it. So why is that? The inability to meet this target is a result of several factors. And certainly there's lawsuits that require us to redirect resources to respond to litigation and may cause us to temporarily halt the issuance of permits while issues are being addressed, such as the temperature standards litigation that has been going on for a while. Permits certainly have become more complex in recent years, requiring more data and complicated analysis and more staff time to develop. Certainly increasing the number of permits to manage, and certainly permit programs staff dropped from 76 FTE in 07-09 to 66 in 13-15 as a result of increased costs and decreased revenues. I had mentioned earlier in one of our policy option packages that I was proposing to work with stakeholders to come up with an idea, really looking deep into our water quality permitting program to come up with recommendations, possibly through a budget note. For as long as I've been with the agency, and I've been with the agency for 18 years, going on 19 years, we have struggled to keep up with water quality, individual water quality permits. And I would say the agency's worked hard to try to find our way out of that. Our stakeholders have worked hard with us. Back to your earlier question, Co-Chair Rayfield, this is really important, as is with air, that permittees get their permit. We can administratively extend permits that allow them to operate. However, permittees need their permit so that they can plan forward to decide what they're going to do. So I've listed some reasons here, and as long as I've been in the agency, we've talked about reasons why we can't get through this permit backlog in a sustainable way. And so I've come to the conclusion that would do us a lot of good to get someone from the outside with expertise to just come in and take a look and give us some recommendations on how we can improve. This is not a statement on the capability and ability of our really good staff. It's just, how do we manage our staff in a way that gets to the end of issuing permits? I think we can do it. I think if we have an outside look, so we're not blinded by our internal views of things, will really help us. And I'm certain that our regulated stakeholders will work with us on that, because, as I said, they really want us to perform. There's no question about that. It's not about that. It's really about, how do we get through this permit backlog in a meaningful, sustainable way.
And I had a couple questions, mm-hmm. just on this. And for historical purposes, it looks like in that 2007, 2008, there were some significant changes to your target with both KPMs. And it looks like on the timeliness, mm-hmm. That increased to 70%. But at the same time, the performance went from almost 48% down to 22%. So mm-hmm. I was curious, why did the target go up? And mm-hmm. at the same time, boy, the performance went down. I mean, it's kind of
right.
Really diverged. And then there's also a similar, in 2007, a little bit of a smaller decrease as far as the target of the percent of wastewater permits that are current. But then also the 2008 actually bumped up a little bit. So I was
Thank you, Chair Rayfield. First of all, let me give you my philosophy on measures and targets. Mm-hmm. I don't think you should set a target that you can just meet. So I think we always have to push ourselves as an agency to do better. In fact, if I came up here and this was all green and say all is good within DEQ, we can't get better, I don't think that would satisfy you. It certainly wouldn't satisfy me. Also, what do we really want in terms of issuing permits in a timely, effective, and a current way? I mean, I don't think stakeholders or myself would like something that 50% is good enough or 30% is good enough. So let's push us. So we did get worse. And again, I highlighted some of the reasons. We had some litigation that kind of got in the way. We had some complications with permits. A lot of factors are in there. One of the reasons we got worse is we rolled up our sleeves several years ago and really focused on improving our backlog of permits. Well, we did that, but we took a lot of staff and put them on that particular task at the expense of doing other things, reviewing discharge monitoring reports, doing inspections. So those fell off while we improved our backlog. So then we get back to them, those issues, which are really important for us to do, and we fall down on our backlog. That's the kind of part that whatever we've been doing hasn't been sustainable. And we have to come up with a sustainable system, not only to show that we're performing, but to ensure our stakeholders are getting the best service from DEQ and that they're getting their permit that is protective of human health and the environment, no question. That's our benchmark. But we really need to get these out. So that's kind of in a very high level, sort of the target setting and performance.
And if you were to, I mean, I know you've kind of listed some of the problems you've been having, but if you were to quantify and say, well, litigation is, you know, say 40% of the problem, or, I mean, to give me a better idea of the problem itself, or because you there were several different factors. I'm kind of curious, what are the significant factors versus what are more of the, you know, minor, maybe they're all equal for that matter.
Chair Rayfield, we haven't quantified it that way. That's something I think maybe a outside consultant can come in and tell us a little bit. However, I would say litigation is definitely a factor. Complexity of permits these days is really a factor. When, you know, many years ago, I used to write water quality permits and they were 10 pages. Now they're like 80 pages in terms of their complexity. Standards are getting more difficult and more challenging to comply with. I think ongoing working very closely with our permittees in terms of getting an application, all that kind of stuff has gotten more complicated. We need to write clarifying implementation management directives that will give staff tools that they can use consistently across the board that we don't have. So there's just a whole, staff, we've had staff turnover. Staff are really good, but, you know, we're losing key staff that have tremendous knowledge of the program, so building that back up. So there's just a whole host of reasons that we haven't specifically quantified. We're working on it. I mean, we're working on all of those things, and we're not going to stop doing that, but really getting some outside help to really make sure we're focused and come up with a more solid implementation plan. Again, being sustainable in terms of issuing permits is really important.
For me, when I'm looking at a problem, I'm saying, okay, this is the significant problem here. The minor ones, we're going to focus on the significant ones because that's going to get us the greatest yield or the greatest improvement in those areas. And so when we were looking at, which POP was it? It was the POP 123, which restores about 6 FTE.
Yes.
I mean, what type of improvement do you expect to see with that POP?
Actually,
would you like to see?
Well, actually, Co-Chair Rayfield, that POP is restoring positions that we already have. That's not adding new positions. So what I look at, back to my outcome-based management approach, is really the work of those staff that are already working at DEQ will continue. But as we look at this in a different way, how do we repurpose the entire, perhaps our entire approach to wastewater permitting, looking at all staff, not just a few staff that are identified in a policy option package. So it's really looking holistically at the program rather than through the lens of just a few people.
And then which, so would it be the, I guess, POP 150, kind of the process improvement POP that's really going to be aimed at trying to create more efficiencies in this program?
Yeah, that one for sure. I also believe that POP 120 is very key. That's replacing wastewater permit management system that modernizes our permit system, so we're doing things electronically and exchanging electronic rather than by hand. So that's very key, along with 150, and certainly getting these positions back is key to continuing our work, or we'll have to sort of figure out how to do it without these positions, which further dilutes the staff that we have.
And then in your, I'm kind of curious, if you were, you know, I guess this is kind of a Senator Devlin question. You know, if you're looking at, you know, how do you, what would you do above and beyond, say, just restoring six staff? Because when I look at the KPMs, we're not making improvement by just maintaining the same level. And if you're short staff, I mean, so really fixing this problem, mm-hmm. if it's a work, you know, overload, would you want to increase staff? Or I mean, I guess, what are your...
Chair Rayfield, one of the things I mentioned in terms of looking at a contractor, I want them to come in and give me a budget neutral recommendation. I don't want to go right out of the gate and say we need a bunch more staff. I think we need to figure out how best to assign those staff, how best to fix our processes. Again, we're working on these things, but just an outside perspective would help us immensely and really start implementing that before I would come back and say, hey, we need a bunch more positions, because I'm not ready to do that unless I prove to myself and prove to our stakeholders that we're making an effort to do better. And believe me, stakeholders have been engaged. We have a blue ribbon committee that's been around for a long while to kind of help with this. So we've been communicating with them. We work with them on their suggestions and advice and work to implement some of those things. But again, there's so many pieces to this that I think really trying to step back, take a broader look, and sort of start repurposing what we got to get to what our responsibility is in this program is to issue permits.
Yes, Senator Dimbro.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You know, it seems to me that if you were just doing a simple thumbs up or thumbs down on a permit, it could be done pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the conditions that you're putting on the permit that I would think take time and mm-hmm. require negotiation, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that kind of how it works? So,
yeah.
You know, you're reviewing the applications, you're analyzing them, you're then trying to come to some sort of agreement on what would be the conditions mm-hmm. that meet the various needs for adopting them.
Yeah.
So is that where most of the holdup of time is?
Chair Rayfield, Senator Dimbro, absolutely. Sort of a little in way of explanation, we talked about this yesterday, setting standards, right? So we set water quality standards, and we show water bodies that are not meeting those water quality standards that's required under the Clean Water Act, and what it takes to reduce pollutant inputs in order to meet water quality standards. That's done through a total maximum daily load. And one of the pieces of that total maximum daily load is to provide what's called a waste load allocation. A waste load allocation is what is given to permittees in order to meet the condition of the total maximum daily load. Those analyses are very, very complex. It's not as simple as, okay, here's the number, meet it. It really is looking at what's the assimilative capacity of a stream, you know, what's the mixing zone that's identified in order for the water to go in, how that's calculated, how that fits into meeting a TMDL allocation. So you're exactly right. It's if we could just, you know, back in the day, I could write an 8-page permit. It was awfully easy. But right now it's far more complex and complicated. And how do those permittees connect to what's going on with non-point source? You know, there's just a whole bunch of factors that weigh in when we're issuing permits that make it more complex. However, we should be able to get it done, I think, if we're more strategic in how we look at doing this, strategic with ourselves and strategic with the folks that we're issuing permits to.
And just to follow up, you know, I noticed that you're in the green on the Title V permit time
mm-hmm.
on this, you know, the air quality. So what's working there that's not working with the water?
Chair Rayfield, Senator Denfro, we have 110 Title V permits. So just sheer numbers help. It's just that's probably a big part of it, and just the nature of how Title V permitting goes. So I think that's probably a big part of it.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Denbrough, I think another probably issue that impacts this is that under the Federal Clean Air Act, I believe Title V permits must be funded by the permit fees.
That's correct.
No general fund can be put in for that program. Unlike the water quality program, there's a lot of general fund. So when the state has problems with general fund, the program experiences cuts where you won't see that in Title V.
I guess some of the concern that I'm hearing is really we're maintaining the same. I guess you're talking about rearranging staff and having kind of trying to achieve more efficiency. But I guess my fear is that 2 years we come back, as we've seen since 2008, and the numbers really the performance has stayed the same, and that's partly my concern. The other thing that that we noted is that on the governor's actually your slides here, there's about six positions that are being cut that have something to do with water, whether it's the TMDL or there's the water quality program office specialist. And while those aren't necessarily directly related to what we're talking about, you have to fulfill that workload in some way. So I guess kind of one of my questions would be, if you lose six FTE, how do you maintain the workload that you currently have without experiencing, decreases in other areas or even more decreases in some of these areas?
Chair Rayfield, good question. We don't, probably. But let me go to your first question as far as performance over 2 years. I will absolutely commit to you that's not my intent to you'll see better performance in 2 years. If we go forward with hiring a contractor out to look at this, it's not going to be a two-year thing. It's going to be a short-term thing. We're going to report back. We're going to implement. We're being very accountable in terms of the numbers, working hard to show improvement in a number of different areas. We're not going to stop that. And what I would hope to do is show improvement, ongoing improvement, starting now with what we're doing and not wait until we get a report from a contractor that's looking at this to implement something. So it's really an ongoing process improvement that we've absolutely committed to doing. So if I come back in 2 years and say, here's our report, we'll get started now, I hope you say something about that. So to your other question, I'd mentioned earlier that we had reduced several of the governor's budget had implemented water quality position reduction. We're also asking for most of those back in policy option packages. So if we didn't get those, we would figure out how not to do that work, and other areas of the water quality permit program would suffer for sure.
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much for putting up with our questions.
Oh, no.
Sorry, I appreciate it.
I don't mind at all.
All right, let's keep moving.
The next one is KPM number 7. I think I talked about this one a little bit. This is mercury removed from the environment, which we're proposing to delete. Our target was 120 pounds of mercury removed in 2013. The result was 13 pounds of removed in 2013. We used to provide free mercury collection opportunities for residents and businesses. So we would collect and weigh that mercury, and certainly that has declined over the years. In 2013, DQ's only remaining mercury reduction strategy was collection for schools through school lab cleanup program. And I talked about our reasons for deleting this. It's not a good measure as far as tracking how much mercury in pounds comes out. It's a good thing to do, but tracking it doesn't help us in terms of our performance. So as I said, we're going to come back with a proposal for a much broader toxics KPM that would be more meaningful across the board when it comes to toxics. Oh. KPM 11.
What is 10?
About 10.
Oh, I'm sorry. 10. Sorry. This is another one we're proposing to change. So just by way of recap, the legislature in 2007 adopted a goal to reduce the cancer risk from exposure to diesel particulate to one cancer in a million over a lifetime of exposure by 2017. DQ has translated that goal into emissions target of no more than 250 tons of diesel particulate emitted in 2017. Emission data is derived from an assessment of all air pollutants from all sources that is compiled every 3 years. The 2011 information is the latest value that we have. The target is 2,100 tons in 2011. The result was 3,900 tons were emitted, so it's kind of a reverse graph, if you will. Certainly diesel emissions remain at unhealthy levels. DQ's clean diesel program has been based on educating fleets about the health risks of diesel emissions and an incentive program to retrofit exhaust systems with particle filters or replace older engines. While we have made progress in emissions, will be reduced over time as a result of fleet turnover with new cleaner engines, DQ projections show that the cancer risk in 2026 will still be five times over the target. About half of this reduction will come from federal standards for new diesel engines that have already been adopted and are phasing in, but the remainder needs to come from state and private actions to upgrade or replace existing engines because diesel engines last a long time and do not turn over quickly. We're very serious about bringing a diesel KPM here that's more meaningful. I think the most significant thing for me is we can only get data once every 3 years, and it's not very good when you're trying to help manage a program to outcome. So that's the kind of thing that we're going to look at when it comes to diesel. All
right. Mr. Chair.
Yes, and Deborah.
This current KPM, it's just statewide. It's not focused on how we're doing in certain regions, right?
That's correct.
And this is a problem that is kind of regional, isn't it, in nature? I mean, there are sort of hot spots around the state where it intersects with problems we're having with air quality in general.
Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Denbro, that's absolutely true. Obviously, where you have more diesel-emitting engines, you have more of a problem. Where there's a lot of construction, where there's a lot of construction equipment with diesel engines, there could be more diesel-emitting areas. The one exception I might say that is that the legislature has worked to take on is emissions from school buses in and around schools that might be not be population-centered, but it's more sector-centered to work on school buses that might be running diesel engines, so working on that. But generally, when you look at emissions overall, absolutely, it's more centered around populations that use a lot of diesel engines that are consolidated.
I'm just wondering in general, as you're setting KPMs, if there's merit in, I mean, most of these seem to be sort of statewide as opposed to, you know, localized problems. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if there's any merit in that.
Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Denbro, we'll certainly take that back. I think that's one way to certainly look at it. We'll make note of that and see what we can look at regionally or sector or whatever a case may be rather than just looking statewide. Mm-hmm. Good suggestion.
One other thing. I mean, you know, I know we've been talking, we're going to have a hearing in a couple of weeks about trying to create a program that would move diesel equipment to the new standards over the next decade or so. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that this is an area where the solution is not dependent or, you know, totally dependent on DEQ staff, right? I mean, certainly such a program would require some staff, but it requires a statewide commitment. And DEQ is responsible for monitoring it, but DEQ can't make the state do this, right?
Chair, Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Dembrough, that's correct.
But you'll be the victim of our inaction in terms of your KPIs. I guess that's not a question.
That'd be a fall guy, Senator Dembrough. Yeah. So that's please continue, Director.
All right. Moving on to the last four, they're kind of together, but I'll walk through them individually. KPM 11A is the number of days when air is healthy for sensitive groups. This measure tracks the number of days when air is unhealthy to breathe for sensitive individuals, like those with asthma and children and the elderly. So our target is 20 unhealthy air days statewide. And the result is we've had 212 unhealthy days statewide. So what does this tell us? In 2013, Oregon experienced a large increase in the number of unhealthy air days. 52 days were attributed to forest fire smoke, and we talked about that yesterday some. But the majority of the remaining unhealthy days were caused by wintertime wood smoke combined with air stagnation conditions that greatly intensified air pollution levels in certain areas. Overall, 23 communities had unhealthy air days, and the largest number of unhealthy air days were in Lakeview that had 38 days and Klamath Falls that had 24 days. We can't control the weather, but reducing smoke, particulate matter from wood smokes and other sources of combustion is essential to reducing the number of unhealthy air days in Oregon. The second half of our measure of the number of days the air is unhealthy to breathe for people who don't have respiratory sensitivity. So how did we perform there? The target is we had, it is to only have 3 unhealthy air days statewide, and the result is we had 68 unhealthy air days statewide. Of the 68 unhealthy air days, 42 were a result of wildfires. The remaining 26 days were caused by wintertime wood smoke combined with air stagnation conditions that greatly intensified air pollution levels. These unhealthy air days were confined to 5 communities. 20 of the 26 days occurred in Lakeview. Certainly the message from these data is the same, that we continue to work on reducing wood smoke matter from areas. And regarding wildfires, Senator Hansel mentioned that yesterday, I think, is continue to work on prescribed burning so that we can do our best to keep wildfires from intruding on communities and keep smoke to a minimum is important. KPM 12 is air toxics trends in larger communities. KPM 12A tracks trends in air toxics levels in large communities. Information is gathered from an air toxics monitoring site in North Portland. It shows the number of times that we monitored levels of 5 typical air toxics that exceed benchmarks or a goal levels that represent levels of acceptable risk to the public. One time above the benchmark represents a level that would cause only a slight amount of risk, whereas pollutant levels many times above the benchmark reflect an increasing level of risk to the public. The toxic pollutants from the bottom up are benzene. If you're looking at your sheet there, benzene, that represents the blue bar. Acetaldehyde is the red bar. Formaldehyde is green. Arsenic is purple, and cadmium is turquoise, in that order. So, so how did we perform? The target is to only be 15 times above the benchmark in 2013. The result, we were 18 times above that benchmark. So it tells us that we have made excellent progress, reducing concentrations by 40% since 2005, with reductions in 4 out of 5 pollutants. Much of the reduction is a result of cleaner vehicle engines with improved fuel economy. There was also less vehicle use during the economic recession, most observable in 2008, but we still have a ways to go, and some of the gains may reverse as the economy picks up again. Strategies to reduce air toxics risk going forward include reducing emissions from wood stoves, cars and trucks, diesel engines, and industrial metals facilities. 12B tracks trends in air toxics levels in smaller communities. This information is gathered from an air toxics monitoring site in La Grande. It shows the number of times that monitored levels of five typical air toxics exceed the benchmarks or goal levels that represent levels of acceptable risk to the public. One time above the benchmark represents a level that would cause only a slight amount of risk, whereas pollutant levels many times reflect an increased level of risk. And it gets the same same pollutants that are measured on the bars that you have. In this, the target was nine times above the benchmark in 2013. That's the target, sorry. In the result, we were 13 times above the benchmark. So this tells us that in La Grande, we have not seen the overall reductions in toxic air pollution that we've seen in Portland. However, the monitored levels are below those measured in Portland. So they're lower, but the exceedances are more frequently. DQ expects benzene levels to fall over time because of the federally mandated reduction in benzene in gasoline that took effect in 2011 and 2012 and because of cleaner cars. However, those reductions may have been offset by increase in vehicle usage as the economy recovers. So going forward, certainly look at strategies to reduce air toxic risks, including reducing emissions from wood stove, cars, trucks, and diesel engines. So those are the reds and yellows on our KPMs. You might wonder why there's an NA under 9B. That's because when you have a zero. Anyway, the KPM benchmark sheet, spread calculation sheet, will not calculate that. That's why it's an NA.
Yeah. Senator Dembrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. With respect to water quality of streams, so the EPA and NOAA have recently criticized our coastal waters, our coastal streams. And I'm just wondering, how does DEQ approach that? How does DEQ address that? Did their disapproval, which could cost us some substantial dollars, what are the causes of the concern, and how is DEQ going to be addressing those?
Sure. Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Dembrough, a little background. Oregon, like many states, operates a coastal zone program. And many years ago, EPA and NOAA Fishery conditionally approved our coastal zone program, as they've done with many states across the United States. And they listed three reasons for their conditional disapproval. One is new development along the coast. Second is on-site septic systems in coastal areas. And the third is Oregon Forest Practices Act. So subsequent to that, there was a lawsuit filed by Northwest Environmental Advocates that challenged EPA and NOAA's the legality of conditionally approving a coastal zone program. So as a result, settlement ensued, and Oregon, I'll talk not just DEQ, but Oregon committed to try to work on those three conditions and convince the federal agencies that we have a viable coastal zone program. We worked hard on that, and we recently just heard from EPA and NOAA that they were going to disapprove our coastal zone program with the hopes that we'll fix things that they think need to be fixed. They said the improvements that we made in on-site, the legislature in 2013 made some improvements in the on-site program, and the improvements we've made in tracking new home development on the coast satisfied them, but they still had concerns about the Oregon Forest Practices Act. The Oregon Department of Forestry and the Board of Forestry are taking that up and working really hard on that. So our role certainly is to support ODF and the Board of Forestry as best we can to provide the information and make changes if changes need to be made that will get us out of that disapproval mode. The outcome, as you rightfully pointed out, is DQ and DLCD lose dollars. We lose what we call $319 that fund some staff and also provide dollars to Watershed Council and others to do riparian improvements, and DLCD will lose some dollars that support their coastal zone program. So we're working very hard, Senator, to try to reverse that opinion by EPA and NOAA, and so we'll we'll hope for the best and work the hardest to get to that end.
Thank you. Okay, follow up. So more specifically, DEQ's role is to monitor the effects of the changes, or mm-hmm. to advise the Board of Forestry, mm-hmm. and then to monitor on the success of the programs that they implement?
Chair Rayfield, Senator Dempro, actually we're taking a more holistic approach. We're looking at this from the state. So what I would say is that we're not overseeing the Board of Forestry or the Department of Forestry. We're working together with them on what might be necessary for monitoring or changes to meet certain water quality standards. So it's not, it's more of, I would call it more collaborative than oversight. And again, we're approaching this from more the state than from one agency.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator. Okay, doesn't look like there's any other questions. Ms. Connolly, we have about maybe, Representative Gomberg.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I had some general questions, but not on the KPMs.
All right, if the director will indulge.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Director. You and I have talked about your agency's use of credit card processing in the past. And my understanding is that that particularly through the vehicle inspection program, you folks are processing about $40 million mm-hmm. a year in credit cards, much of which is being transferred to DMV for other purposes. Mm-hmm. Could you talk to us just a little bit about that $40 million, how you're processing and what's going on there with DMV?
Sure. So our vehicle inspection program, what it does is test vehicles, obviously, and we went from a cash check system some years ago to do a credit card payment, and we used to have an old dial-up system that would take forever, and then we switched to not a dial-up, but more the modernized version of that. And sort of backing up a little bit, in when someone goes through a vehicle inspection station, they not only get their car tested, but they get their DMV plate. So our fee is in Portland $21, and I can't remember what it is for the plate. It's 100 and something. But we collect the money because we're there, and then we provide payment back to DMV for that. So to do that, as I understand, I'm not an expert in this area, but there is a third party that verifies the credit card payment and then and transfers and verifies with U.S. Bank, I think is our carrier, verifies that payment is legitimate. And then for that service, for that third party, I think what we reported to you is we pay. Our share of that is $96,000 per year, I think it is, that we pay for that service.
I just follow up, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, that's consistent, Mr. Director, with the information I've got as well. And I don't want to take a lot of time with this now, but I'd appreciate learning later. The $96,000 that you folks are paying would be only for the portion of the dollars that come back to you. And I don't have a clear picture of the $40 million, much is going through you and how much is going to DMV.
Chair Rayfield, Representative Gumberg, we'll clarify. We'll get all that information for you. Yeah.
Yes, Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Well, since we're asking general questions, and you brought up the DEQ testing center, we talked about this a little bit in my office, and I want to sort of ask, because we heard some of this in transportation last year, the rationale for continuing, running my car through DEQ. So I just went and personally did that the other day. Have about 120,000 miles on my car. It passed no problem. Clearly, in a time when cars were struggling with emission standards, it made a lot of sense to have cars that were, have this program, but more than 90% of cars now pass DEQ. Mm-hmm. We exempt cars that are 25 years and older. We only do it in specific areas of the state. It's not required all through the state. So what's the rationale for continuing this program? And is it self-sufficient on the fees alone, or are we subsidizing it with other money elsewhere in the budget?
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Parrish, thank you for asking. I'm glad your experience with DEQ was good. That's what it was. So what I'll start is I talked about the ozone standard. And ozone is, EPA is going to change the ozone standard to make it more restrictive. And vehicle emissions are one of the primary causes of smog or ozone in an area. So that's something we have to keep an eye on. So if the ozone standard in, say, is lowered to a point where Portland is in jeopardy or close to being in jeopardy, or Medford is as well, once we get into non-attainment, it's a problem for businesses. So that's sort of waiting and seeing what that ozone standard is very important. We are, as you pointed out, we do provide exemptions, and we're looking at newer cars. We're exempting, we're only testing 4-year older cars or older. That's more than the average across the nation. We're looking at all ways to modernize and making it more efficient to make that experience work better. We're doing a self-service drive up where people can do it by self-service. Some of the data that we've looked at is that even having a vehicle inspection program will help maintain compliance for newer cars. What we've looked at in other states and compared it to, that there's up to a 20% or more failure of new cars when people don't have to have them checked because their engine light goes on, or that check engine light goes on and they just have it turned off and don't fix the emission systems. So that's something we're keeping an eye on. More importantly, I think we just really have to keep looking at this system in a way that it does what it's intended to do, which is to protect air quality and ensure that air quality is protected and that it's the most efficient system that we can have for the users of it. And to answer your last question, this program is not subsidized by other funds. It's fully paid for by fees.
So a couple things. Mm-hmm. Well, when you talk about in other states, if they've relaxed that standard and somehow the check engine light comes on, and I'm not an auto person. Mm-hmm. I just want the car to run, so I don't know how it works. But, you know, usually that comes on because I've ignored an oil change or, you know, so what is it specifically that somebody could be ignoring that is changing, you know, and I'm like terrible with auto care. So what is it somebody's specifically ignoring that would suddenly change the emissions? And it seems like when I run through like a Jiffy Lube or something, nothing they do there is fixing an emissions problem. If I'm, you know, doing regular maintenance on my car. The other piece, so you talked about ozone standards, and you mentioned that in my office about the EPA and changing standards. So if the EPA changes their standards, and now I run through my car through DEQ and it doesn't meet the standard, will it ever meet the standard as an older vehicle? You know, given that it is an older vehicle, the standard has changed, the car might not have been designed that way. How do you handle cars that fall into that gap? Or are you expecting that suddenly a lot of people's cars will fall into that window if the EPA standards change?
Co-Chair Rayfield, Representative Parrish, the area-wide standard is changing for ozone. It doesn't translate to a more restrictive emission requirement at the vehicle. At least that's my understanding. So it's not going to cause a vehicle to do more because we have a tighter airshed standard. So that's not going to change. The first question again
was about, like, you know, when you said that you know, if we exempt cars, other states where they've exempted cars, you know, suddenly are presenting with, you know, cars that are in failure. I mean, like, where would a consumer even see how their car is failing by lack of maintenance? Like, when that engine light comes on for me, it's usually because I've missed an oil change.
Right.
And I'm like 3,000 miles overdue. I don't think that would cause my car to suddenly have an emissions problem.
Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator, Representative Parrish, there's many, many reasons. As you know, vehicles now are computers, and the computer systems in there control many things, including emissions. And they will warn you when you need an oil change or things like that. But there are emission equipment that will show up as a check engine light if they fail. I'm not the person that has that whole list of things, but we can provide that to you, what sort of diagnostics needs to happen when a check engine light comes on. I think it's simply plugging into a computer and it'll tell you what's failed.
My follow-up comment is just, I think of all the things, I don't get a lot of constituent complaints, but one of the things I do get is people are like, why are we still doing this practice? Mm-hmm. I'll be honest, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me if cars are passing and we're collecting a fee from people whose cars are passing, and then suddenly somebody's car who's not passing is, you know, exempt anyway because that car's aged out of the system. Mm-hmm. It feels really redundant to continue to offer that. I know that there was, you know, we discussed that there was a budget note in 2013 to look at that and bring back information, and I'm not sure if that information's been brought back either to the Transportation Committee or whoever asked for that information, but at some point I would like to see that because, you know, we had this conversation several times since I've been here, is what are sort of outdated functions or things we, you know, are continuing to do because maybe we have an internal constituency group who's delivering those services, or, you know, are we meeting the standards? Has the mission been fulfilled? And this is one that I do hear from people about in my community, and they don't ask me for a lot, but it is when I'm out knocking doors, why do I have to take my car through the DEQ when my car is going to pass, and it passes every year? They just, you know, feel like they're getting nickeled and dimed by their government, and I don't blame them for that. So
okay.
More comment than anything.
All right. Any further questions? Senator Hansel.
Just a thank you for responding. You said one of the members' questions. Well, it was my question on the food, and I appreciate your response. Thank you.
You bet.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, I'm cognizant of the time as well. I just wanted to say I wanted to thank you and the committee for bearing with me as I continue to ask agencies these questions about credit cards. This one example today suggests that at the standard rate through our treasurer's office, they'd be collecting about $500,000 in commissions paid to an outside administrator. Senator Hansel and I heard from another small agency yesterday that reported they were paying about $2 million in commissions. These dollars are going to add up. I'm not suggesting anything's wrong anywhere. I'm just trying to get a better sense of the big picture.
Yeah, well, thank you, Representative Gomberg. And with that, we'll hear from Ms. Connolly and Mr. Whitman tomorrow morning, and we'll adjourn the meeting.